willing to stay and answer questions at the end. I know some people have other commitments, but wow, what a... I just have to mention that some people have traveled long distances to be here, and I commend each and every one who's made the effort, whether it be an airplane ride or a long car ride. It's all about recovery. It's all about taking this back with you and carrying it to the next person that you meet. This is being recorded. Bob told me that normally they would have recordings available tonight. Yeah. It's a short notice. Not sure we're going to have today's session tonight. But if you get a hold of Bob, he will make sure that if you want a copy of this, whatever the fee is, I'm sure it's nominal compared to the information that was put on there. You notice I go quite rapidly, and part of that's because it's being taped. Get the tapes, listen to them again and again and again, and when you have any questions, call me. Okay.
Bassett's going around to help cover the cost today. A quick announcement, the speaker meeting tonight is the normal first Saturday No-Res speaker meeting. Starts at 7 o'clock right out in the gym. The Al-Anon speaker is first, and it'll be Gordon G. from, or Gordon, B. from Auburn. And then Wally will be the AA speaker. And tomorrow at 1 o'clock in this room, we'll be doing the Back to Basics sponsorship and walking through the 12 steps for 2 hours, roughly, starting 1 o'clock tomorrow. Right here.
1 o'clock. Thank you. 1 o'clock.
And any questions after this session, Wally will be here for a while. And then we need to put him away for a little while to rest.
We need to put Wally away.
Yeah.
I've actually heard that before. Oh no, I've got quite a few Seattle stories to tell as I tell my story tonight. Okay. Welcome back to session number 2 of the History of Alcoholics Anonymous. This session I've titled Unsung Heroes. I want to spend a few minutes and talk about Lois Wilson and Ann Smith. Lois Burnham Wilson, the co-founder of Al-Anon and wife of Bill W., the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, has contributed to the recovery movement in ways that many people have never really known or understood. I'm going to take a few minutes and not only talk about her, but also about the source documentation that I used to write this tribute to her. I'm going to describe her contribution to her husband's work in the 1920s when Bill became a financial research analyst for Wall Street. In addition, I'll show how she assisted Bill with the preparation and distribution of his vitamin B3 therapy papers in the 1960s. Not expecting anybody to know about the material from the 1920s, but has anybody ever heard of the vitamin B3 papers from Bill W.? Yeah, see, these are all lost pieces of history, so let me get right to it. Source documentation. I have in my possession one of the 50 copies of Lois's diaries from 1925 and 1926. It was a gift from an archivist in Central California. Can't make copies of it. It is copywritten. What I do have is the opportunity to present material based on it. This is when Bill and Lois were visiting various companies to determine whether or not their Wall Street friends and acquaintance should invest in them. Based on their field research and subsequent investments, Bill and Lois became quite wealthy during the 1920s. But as was the case with many others during this period of time, they lost everything during the stock market crash of 1929. Has anybody ever heard of the Diary of Two Motorcycle Hobos? One person? Yeah. And Lois remembers there's a lot of material that was actually taken from the diaries, but that wasn't really attributed to the diaries. But these are her actual diaries from that period of time. And what an honor it is to be able to present some of this material. Now, the three vitamin B3 papers were published in December 1965, February 1968, and January 1971. By 1971, Bill was terminally ill. He passed away on January 24th of that year. Lois helped assemble the research and wrote the cover letter for the final publication of the vitamin B3 papers. This is where Bill had discovered that the vitamin B3 was a cure for depression. It cured his depression. He was had serious, serious depression issues. It also takes away the cravings for alcohol, takes away the cravings for sugar, and it strips the cholesterol out of your arteries. And all of this was discovered in the 1960s. This is not part of AA. This was after Bill had turned to AA over to the fellowship. Bill did this on his own. But again, you talk about revolutionary. This guy was decades ahead of his time on this stuff. Before I go any further into Bill Lois' work on vitamin B3, let me make this medical disclaimer. Medical supervision is essential when taking therapeutic dosages of vitamin B3. Take only as prescribed and monitored by a medical doctor. I am actually on a pharmaceutical grade niacin from the VA in Tucson, Arizona. I take 2 grams a day to prevent a heart attack. I take 1 gram a day to alleviate depression. So even in 2014, it's still being used and it's still approved therapeutic. The contents of the second paper, we have 3 primary contributors. Dr. Russell Smith, who is Dr. Bob's nephew, living in Detroit, the Brighton Hospital in Detroit. Another medical report was submitted by Dr. David Hawkins, who at the time was the director of the largest psychiatric hospital in the United States, the North Nassau Mental Health Center on Long Island. I did get a chance to meet Dr. Hawkins and spend time with Dr. Hawkins. When he retired from Long Island, he moved to Sedona, Arizona. Again, another one of these divine coincidences, right? I get a chance to actually spend time. And this was Bill's psychiatrist during the 1960s. Yeah, Dr. Hawkins, and he was a major proponent of B3. Dr. Edwin Boyle was also instrumental. He worked at the Miami Heart Institute, and what he had discovered is that niacin would prevent a second heart attack. Later, in the 70s, he discovered that niacin would prevent a first heart attack. Again, a piece of history that nobody's even familiar with. Yes?
Was it true that Bill also took LSD?
We'll leave that for another time, okay? Yeah. Let's just say that Bill was looking for a cure for his depression. He was looking for a way to help alcoholics who weren't getting it in the rooms. And it was the same 2 doctors that came up with the LSD cure. I have the book, Cure for Alcoholism, LSD, which turned out to be negated in the ensuing years. But the same 2 doctors came up with the B3 therapy, Dr. Hoffer and Osmond. In addition, When Love Is Not Enough, the Lois Wilson story, and Lois Remembers. Lois Remembers is one of the best AA history books ever written. Why so? She was sober.
Yeah.
She wasn't just trying to figure this out. She was there, and she was clear-headed, and she was a writer. And she loved so much of this town. And of course, they do describe the journey on the motorcycle in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Lois was born on March 4th, 1891 at the family home at 182 Clinton Street in Brooklyn Heights, New York City, 182 Clinton Street. 182 Clinton Street is where Emmy met Bill, very important to meeting in November of 1934. Her father was a gynecologist and a surgeon. After kindergarten, Lois attended Quaker School for 8 years. After graduating from Quaker School, she attended Packer Collegiate Institute for 5 years. In addition to being an exceptional student, Lois was an excellent athlete. You'd have to be to drive a Harley around the country for 2 years. After Packer, she studied drawing and painting at the New York School of Fine and Applied Art. She was an excellent pianist. The Burnham family spent their summers at a cottage on Emerald Lake in North Dorset, Vermont. In 1914, even though Lois worked at the YWCA in Brooklyn, she got on a train and spent practically every weekend at the lake. This is a cabin on the lake. Yeah, that's the cabin in from North Dorset, Vermont. Bill was born and raised in East Dorset, Vermont, at a country inn. And Lois met Bill W. in May of 1914. Bill was selling kerosene lanterns to help pay for his expenses at Norwich University, a military college in Northfield, Vermont. He was studying electrical engineering. Bill and Lois became engaged during the summer of 1915. At the time, Bill was 19 years old, Lois was 24. Bill and Lois were married on January 24th, 1918. In the summer of 1918, Bill was sent to Fort Adams near Newport, Rhode Island. And here they are in Newport, Rhode Island. Amazing the number of photographs that have been saved over the years, them especially in their early years. In the summer of 1918, as I said, Bill was sent to Fort Adams in Newport. Lois took an apartment nearby. Bill shipped out to Europe in August of 1918. While Bill was overseas, Lois took a job working in the shell shock ward at Battery Hospital in Washington, D.C. Amazing, co-founder of Al-Anon, working with PTSD patients in the First World War. Bill returned from Europe in January of 1919 and was mustered out of the service in May. By this time, Bill's drinking was already a problem. One incident that showed how out of control Bill was took place soon after his return from overseas. And this is a quote from the Lois Wilson story. Lois came home early one afternoon to find Bill and her brother Rogers drunk in the basement. They had made a shambles of the place. Broken bottles were shattered everywhere. Lois had never seen her brother so intoxicated before and never saw him that way afterward. With Bill, it was no longer a surprise. It was also during this time that Bill started having more and more severe bouts of depression. This is how William Borchett, who wrote Lois's story, describes these depressions. Lois remained encouraging no matter how depressed Bill became at times. He quit his job at the New York Central Railroad and began bouncing from one dead-end job to another, growing more and more discouraged. It was those depressions that concerned Lois the most. They would be with her husband on and off for years. They would actually remain with Bill until 1960, when Dr. Osmond and Dr. Hoffer introduced him to B3 and nutritional therapy. In 1925, Bill and Lois experienced a turning point in their lives. At this time, Bill was working as an investigator looking into defaults of stock exchange firms on Wall Street. Bill enjoyed the work and developed a reputation as an excellent investigator. One night in early March, Bill came home so drunk he fell asleep on the couch with all his clothes on. The next morning, Bill said, "Lo, let's get out of here. I've been thinking this idea I have, it can change everything. I know it can. Nobody's ready to back me yet because they don't understand. They can't see it. But would you take a chance with me, Lo? I finally realized I just can't go on like this anymore." They sat at the kitchen table and over coffee, Bill outlined his plan. He wanted to travel the country with her. He wanted to visit companies, get on the inside, find out what was really going on, and write reports for Wall Street investors who could put their money to sure winners. He felt certain that once some Wall Street investors saw what he could deliver about a company's growth and earnings potential, they'd pay handsomely for such information. And handsomely they did pay for it. First, Bill would buy a few shares of stock in the companies he wanted to investigate, just enough to give him an entree as a stockholder. This way he could have access to top management. He would also go in the back door and talk to the workers who knew all about the quality of the things they were producing. And a lot of these conversations with the workers were held in speakeasies. Consuming alcohol was prohibited at the time. Speakeasies everywhere, didn't stop anybody. And then he checked the firm's reputation in the community and within the industry. By the time he was finished, his investigative skills would have gleaned all the in-depth knowledge any investor would need to make an intelligent decision. That weekend, Bill and Lois went to an Army surplus store in Brooklyn. They purchased a used Harley-Davidson motorcycle with a large sidecar. Lois purchased a 7-foot tent and a 7-foot tall and 7-foot wide from Sears and Roebuck. She stitched a window with netting for ventilation. When it came to packing food, toiletries, pajamas, towels, and other miscellaneous items, Lois was quite ingenious. She made storage containers out of black oilcloth and lined them with rubber and tape to make them waterproof. She even made watertight coveralls for her and Bill and waterproof containers to protect everything they took with them. A week prior to their departure, Bill drove the motorcycle with Lois in the sidecar out to Prospect Park, Brooklyn. There he taught Lois how to drive the Harley, which she mastered in one day. So there's the Harley Davidson unloaded and loaded. It's just amazing to me that they actually pulled this off. And they did. And we do have the timeline from Lois's diaries. It's just one of the things, the various places they stopped, and she wrote about each and every one of these. Each and every one of these was a diary entry. And they took off on April 16th, 1925. These are a couple examples of her writing. This is her diary entry from April 16th, 1925, near Poughkeepsie, New York. That was the day they took off. "It is cold in April riding a motorcycle without a windshield, but breathing in the ozone," yeah, without a windshield. "But breathing in the ozone as we whiz along is most invigorating. When sitting on the driver's seat and turning on the gas, I feel as if the whole world were mine. The sense of power, somehow not the machine's, but mine, is tremendous." You get what she's saying? She's driving the Harley. Bill spent most of these 2 years in the sidecar, either sleeping it off or scheming about the next place they were going to go to. We are offered, yeah. Oh, this is a staged photograph. This is one that is in a lot of the historical books and records, and this is staged. As I just said, Lois drove the Harley. It was in the sidecar. We are, we are off at last, and with such a time as we had hitching and tying all our bundles on the motorcycle before leaving Brooklyn this morning, the passersby must have thought we were bound for the Arctic with presents for the Eskimos. I love her writing style. At the bow, on the rear, the sidecar, behind the driver, or in between, we finally found niches for everything we could possibly need during the year. Books and radio, gasoline stove and basket of provisions, 7 army blankets, a mattress, a small trunk full of clothes, a tent, and many odds and ends, including ourselves, under several layers of underwear and as many strata sweaters. Our friends and relatives bid us goodbye as if in truth we were headed for the Arctic, for most of them considered it just as wild and crazy an undertaking. No doubt they were right, for we both tossed up good jobs and have but slim funds for a long trip, planning to stop and earn more as soon as we run out. And then as they move on, July 22nd, 1925, and I think it's Scotia or Scotia. Oh, I like that even better. Thank you. Scotia, New York. And this is the diary entry. We both have jobs, both of us, working on a farm. Bill's boast that he was a good milker punched the matter. Probably made that up too. So we are hired to help at $75 a month for both the board and keep. I'm to assist with the housework and Bill's to milk the cows and work on the fields. After working on the farm for several weeks, Bill was invited to join the farm owner's boys at Dawson's Cafe, which happened to be one of the 2 speakeasies in Schenectady. And here's where Bill really turns on the charm. That night turned into the kind of colossal event Bill would never forget. First, he bought a few rounds of beers, having one himself naturally. Then, after convincing the farm owner, his boys, he once worked for Thomas Edison, which he never did. It's just an embellishment, maybe a little embellishment. Bill won a science fair, and Thomas Edison actually shook his hand. But listen to how he put it. After convincing the farm owner of the boys he once worked for Thomas Edison, which they did work for him, which he never did, he said he still was not permitted to reveal the fantastic inventions on the Edison's drawing board. Feeling challenged, the farm boys, again under the influence, drove Bill out to the GE research facility where they worked and showed him the fantastic things they were involved in. Bill couldn't believe his eyes. There stretched out before him was a display of equipment and prototype devices only hinted at in science magazine. Experiments in sound motion pictures, electric photographs, magnets, and all sorts of shortwave communications. In less than an hour, Bill had the inside track on what General Electric was soon to become. The following day, Bill sent a brief note to Frank Shaw, a Wall Street broker and friend of the Griffith family, a friend of Lois's family, about his look inside GE's research laboratory. Lois helped him write the letter. He requested a meeting with Frank to present a detailed report. And from that report, he received seed money to continue to make visits all up and down the East Coast. Again, we have everything documented in her diaries. There was a trip to Fort Myers, Florida to visit Bill's mother and stepfather. And I've spent quite a bit of time in Florida. This is the Thomas Edison home. This is the Henry Ford home. And this is again one of the integral parts of the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous. If we trace Alcoholics Anonymous through New York, it's Roland carrying the message to Ebbie carrying the message to Bill, and then Bill having a conversion experience in Towns Hospital, and then carrying the message to Bob. From the Akron perspective, it started in Winchendon, Massachusetts. From there, it went to Fort Myers, Florida, and I've done all the Fort Myers research. That's another presentation I made. From there, it went to Denver, Colorado, and from Denver, Colorado, it went to Akron. And the four founding moments, so this is one of the founding moments from the Akron perspective, but Bill doesn't meet any of these people, but he's so close to them at that period of time. Even had the opportunity to spend some time with Henry Ford when he was there. I did find maps. I did find where the houseboat was tied up. I did walk where Bill walked, where Bill Lewis walked. That's not how it looked back then. That's how it looks today. And again, he had the opportunity to meet Henry Ford when he was there. And Henry Ford, again, became a major supporter of the Oxford Group, which he belonged to. Again, when we talk about unsung heroes, we have Henry Ford, Thomas Edison, and Harvey Firestone. Harvey Firestone's on the right. It's Harvey Firestone's son, Bud Firestone, that got sober in Denver and brought the Oxford Group to Akron. So we have linkage with all these wonderful people. Thomas Edison, Henry Ford, Harvey Firestone. And again, here he is in Alabama visiting a steel mill. I mean, he just he was a multimillionaire. In 1929, it all crashed. Bill and Lois lose their fortune in the stock market crash of 1929. Bill becomes a hopeless and unemployed chronic alcoholic. Lois works at a department store in order to support both of them. In October 1928, November 1928, January 1929, and September 1930, Bill pledges in writing in Lois's Bible that he will never drink again. And he, because of his alcoholism, he is unable to keep any of these pledges. And then in November 1934, Bill and Lois are visited by MET again. Bill didn't mention that Lois was there also. She prepared dinner for them. As a direct result of Ebbie's visit, Bill checks himself in Towns Hospital on December 11, 1934. While in the hospital, Bill has a conversion experience and never drinks again. After Bill's release from Towns Hospital, Bill and Lois start attending Oxford Group meetings together. In May 1935, Bill leaves for Akron to attempt a company takeover of the National Rubber Machine Company. The venture fails and Bill's associates leave him in Akron to try to salvage a deal. And that's when he makes the famous phone calls for the Mayflower Hotel and meets Dr. Bob S. Bill stays with Dr. Bob and Ann during the summer of 1935. In early July 1935, Lois visits Bill in Akron during her one-week vacation from Lozer's department store. There, Lois and Ann start working with the wives of alcoholics. It started in the kitchen of Dr. Bob's home. In 1938, Lois introduces herself to Ann Bingham, who was waiting in a car outside 182 Clinton Street while her husband attended one of Bill's nameless bunch of drunk meetings in the living room. Lois invites Ann and the other ladies to join her in the kitchen so they could talk. The wives of the alcoholics continue to meet informally in the kitchen until Lois and Bill are forced to go home at 182 Clinton Street on April 26, 1939. During the 1940s, family groups came out throughout the United States and Canada. In May 1951, Lois and Ann opened a service office at Stepping Stones, Bill Willis's home in Bedford Hills, New York. The 49 groups choose to call themselves Al-Anon Family Groups. In January 1952, Lois Mann moved the service office to the 24th Street Clubhouse in New York City. Volunteers come to assist in the day-to-day operations. By now, Al-Anon has 200 registered groups. From these humble beginnings, Al-Anon has continued to grow, and over the years has helped millions of family members and friends of alcoholics help find help for their difficulties. And I'm going to close this presentation on Lois with the cover letter she wrote for the third Vitamin 3 paper. As I said earlier, the contributors were Dr. David Hawkins, Dr. Edwin Boyle, and Dr. Russell Smith. Although vitamin B3 can reduce the risk of heart disease and has shown promise in the treatment of depression and hypoglycemia, it has some serious side effects. In dosages large enough to show a therapeutic effect, it causes in many people an unpleasant flushing sensation. If anybody's ever tried it, you turn red as a beet. The pharmaceutical grade doesn't turn you red as a beet. That's why I'm on pharmaceutical B3. In terms of the flushing, this was so beautiful because I got to know Nell Wayne, Bill's secretary, very well over the years. And hi, Nell. God, I love that lady. But what she would say is that vitamin B3 was obviously working because Bill's depression was greatly reduced. But when he was flushing, Bill's face was beet red for about an hour or so. It was quite noticeable. In order to reduce Bill's self-consciousness about the flushing, many of us in the office would take the B3 along with him so we could all flush together. That's a Nell was a Buddhist. Nell was quite concerned when the big book was being sent over to the Far East, and Lois said, "Bill, you don't have anything to worry about. The Buddhist tradition and AA are very much intertwined." So we have Nell to thank for that too. And this is the cover letter that Lois wrote. "Dear Dave, Ed, and Russ, Aldous Huxley, a great admirer of AA, introduced Bill to two psychiatrists who were researching the biochemistry of alcoholism. Bill was convinced of the truth of their findings and realized he could again help his beloved alcoholics by telling them about this probable aid for the physical component of alcoholism. He recognized that this work must be kept separate and distinct from AA and wrote a letter to the AA board so stating. As you know, Bill's last years were mainly devoted to the spread of this information among alcoholics and other ill persons. With your help, he wrote and distributed to AA doctors a brochure which has twice been enlarged and brought up to date. Before he passed on, he dictated a letter stating his hopes that you three doctors who are interested in AA and have worked closely with him in the niacin field would extend your endeavors along the latter lines. I sincerely believe that you only want what is best for the sick alcoholic who as yet has not been able to stay sober in AA, and that you will continue to place the principles AA first and researching second. Bill's great hope was that continued research would find a means whereby those thousands of alcoholics who want to stop drinking but are too ill to grasp the AA program could be released from their bondage and enabled to join AA. All good wishes, affectionately, Lois." Lois was a special woman who did so much to help so many. Now I'd like to turn to our other unsung hero, Ann Smith. Ann Smith was described by Bill W. as the mother of Alcoholics Anonymous. During the summer of 1935, when Bill W. was living with the Smiths at 855 Ardmore Avenue in Akron, Ohio, it was Ann who led the morning guidance meetings, which later became 11-step meetings. She also led many of the evening Oxford group meetings. In the summer of 1935, Ann was the teacher and Bill and Bob were the students. and I'm going to explain how that came to be. She kept a notebook that contained her personal writings on the principles of the Oxford Group. Much of what she wrote about was incorporated into the big book. I have her entire diary, her entire personal writings. Some of her journal entries were typed by Sue Smith Windows, Dr. Bob and Ann's daughter. This is Sue Smith Windows' typed up entry on Sharon. I love what she wrote about Sharon, which became our fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh step. All sharing must be under guidance. Never betray a confidence. Never share anyone else's inventory. Pray before you share quietly. And I'll present more on her writings shortly. The typewriter Sue used to type up Ann's notebook and is still on display at the Smith residence in Akron. Sue was learning how to type, and Ann gave her some of her journal pages to practice on. That's how this all came to pass. About 28 of the journal pages hadn't been typed up, and here was where both Sue and Dr. Bob's son Smitty came to the rescue. Sue and Smitty helped me decipher much of the handwriting. Both of them became very good friends. Sue asked me to call her mom, and Smitty actually sponsored my daughter in Al-Anon. In addition to being a caretaker for the personal archives of Dr. Bob and Ann Smith, I received a great deal of material. There's Smitty, there's Sue. From the Wellesley College in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Ann attended Wellesley from 1899 to 1903. So I called and asked if they had anything on her. A month later, I received a package of more than 50 pages of archival materials. As Bill Delbert used to say, this was a 10 strike, and all I had to do was ask. And nobody else had ever asked before I did. I was the first person to have this material. Before we examine Ann's spiritual writings in more detail, I'd like to present some of the biographical material we have on her. She was born on March 21st, 1881, in the Chicago area of Illinois. Along with her three brothers, she was raised in Oak Park, Illinois. The family lived at 414 South Maple Street. The house is still standing. I have visited it. Her father worked for the railroad. In high school, she excelled academically and won a scholarship to Wellesley College. She graduated from Wellesley College in 1903 with a degree in liberal arts, which was the only degree that was issued by Wellesley at the time. After graduating from college, Ann returned to Oak Park, where she taught school until 1915. Several years ago, I had the opportunity to visit Oak Park to do some archival research. Armed with the material from Wellesley College archives, I was able to find the home where Ann was raised and the school where she taught after her graduation. In terms of the home, it looks like it was in the process of being remodeled. It doesn't look like it's going to be torn down anytime soon. Thank you, Oak Park, Illinois. And the school, we found the old wing where Ann actually taught English because the cornerstone said this part of the high school was completed in 1904. In 1898, Ann met Robert Holbrook Smith at a dance in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Ann was on holiday with a school friend. During the next 17 years, Ann and Bob kept in touch, saw each other when possible, and corresponded regularly. The reason for the long courtship was not clear, but in those days it was customary for the groom to be financially secure before entering into matrimony. After some difficulty, alcohol related, Bob obtained a medical degree from Rush University near Chicago in 1910. Dr. Bob and Ann were married at their parents' home, the home that I just showed you, on January 25th, 1915. After their marriage, Dr. Bob and Ann moved to Akron, Ohio, and shortly thereafter to 855 Ardmore Avenue. Ann gave birth to a son named Smitty on June 5th, 1915. In 1923, Dr. Bob and Ann adopted a daughter named Sue, who was also 5 years old at the time. In January 1933, Stan, along with Henry Osarli, joined the Oxford Group and started AVD in Akron. Of the four leaders of the Oxford Group in Akron, Ohio, three of them were women. And Henry Osarli, Ann Smith, and Clarice Williams. T. Henry Williams, her husband, was the fourth. So there were four people involved in getting the Oxford Group up and running in Akron. And some of them you've heard of before, T. Henry and Clarice Williams. Meetings were held there on Wednesday night. Sue told me there was a meeting on Monday night also. It took me years and years to actually validate what she said. The Monday night meeting was held at the home of Bud and Dorothy Firestone. So the Firestone meeting was on Monday night. The Williams meeting was Wednesday night. From 1933 to 1939, Anne recorded Oxford Group and Other Spiritual Principles in a notebook. She was asked to speak from the podium. She was asked at conferences and conventions to do workshops. She was plugged in. Anne and Henrietta performed an intervention on Dr. Bob in April of 1935. I do that in another presentation, the intervention. Shortly after this meeting, Anne invited Bill Ann and Smitty accompanied Dr. Bob to Henrietta's home on May 12, 1935 to meet Bill W., who was visiting from New York City. And shortly after this meeting, Ann invited Bill to move in with Dr. Bob, herself, and Sue at 855 Ardmore Avenue. What happened in the summer of 1935 was Smitty was moved off to a fraternity house in Akron. And Sue was moved up into the attic. Her bedroom became Bill's bedroom, and the front bedroom became the jitter joint detox drying out room. So that's where they started practicing on alcoholics. the jitter joint, yeah. So the front room with that eve that we're looking at, that was the jitter joint. Yeah, the second window back on the right, that would be Sue's room, and Dr. Bob and Ann were on the left-hand side of the second floor. Bill lived with the Smiths during the summer of 1935. It was during this time that AA was born. In the early part of 1936, Ann organized a women's group for the wives of alcoholics. During the 1940s, Ann attended meetings of the first Akron AA group, King's School, on a regular basis. She passed away on June 1st, 1949. Many, many people have written many, many very, very positive things about Ann. I'm just going to concentrate on a couple of them. And this is a picture of her as a young age in the house at 855 Ardmore Avenue. This is what Johnny R. had to say about the meetings in Dr. Bob and Ann's home. Before these meetings, Ann used to pull out a little book, her spiritual journal, and quote from it. We would discuss it, then we'd see what Ann would suggest from it for our discussion. And this is what Bill had to say about his stay at the Smith residence. For the next 3 months, I lived with these two wonderful people, Bill said. I shall always believe they gave me more than I ever gave them. Every morning was a devotion, he recalled. After a long silence in which we awaited inspiration and guidance, Anne would read from the Bible. James was our favorite, he said. Reading from a chair in the corner, she would softly conclude, faith without works is dead. Bill writes, faith without works is dead, three times in the big book, as a tribute to Ann Smith and all the things he learned from her in that summer of 1935. And this is how Sue Smith Windows, Dr. Bob's daughter, described the one guidance meetings. She was 17 years old at the time. Then someone said, and she was at every one. As I said, Sweetie had moved off to a fraternity campus, but Sue was at every meeting. And she didn't go willingly. She used to try to hide. And they would always find her in the closet somewhere and drag her down to this guidance meeting. She thought everybody was a nutcase in that room. Then somebody said a prayer, she recalled. After that, we were supposed to say one ourselves. Then we'd be quiet. Finally, everybody would share what they got or didn't get. This lasted for at least half an hour and sometimes went as long as an hour. And these are some of the things that are in Ann Smith's journal. Again, she wrote extensively about the four spiritual activities. Surrender, again, these were handwritten. Took us a while to translate them. Surrender is a simple act of will. What do we surrender? Our life. When? At a certain definite moment. How? Oh, God, manage me because I cannot manage myself. That's a good third step prayer for you. And try to bring a person to a decision to surrender as much of himself as he knows to as much of God as he understands. Stay with him until he makes a decision and says it aloud. Sam Shoemaker and Ann Smith are the only two written pieces of documentation that we have for this statement. We surrender as much of God as we know. We surrender as much of ourselves as we know to as much of God as we understand, which later became God as we understood it. This is where God as we understood came from. I know there's some talk about Jimmy Burwell having something to do with it, but primarily it goes back to Sam Shoemaker and Ann Smith. Sharing. Why are people so afraid to face their deepest problems? Or step, because they think there is no answer. When they learn there is one, they will believe it will work for them, and they will be really honest about themselves. What do we share? Liabilities, anger, irritability, jealousy, hurt feelings, self-pity, sentimentality, which is enjoyment without responsibility. These are wasted emotions. Guidance, test your thoughts. It's possible to receive suggestions from your subconscious mind, check your thoughts by the four standards. Again, the honesty, purity, and selfishness in love. This is what she writes on quiet time. This cannot be emphasized too much. Not a day should be missed. The early morning hours are best. Maybe that more than one quiet time will be needed during the day. Whenever need arises, one should stop and pray and listen. Which Bill incorporates into step 11. When agitated or doubtful, pause, pray and listen, and ask for the right thought or actions. I'll go for it. Again, quite a bit of linkage between Ann's journals and the big book. This is just some of her guidance. She write very, very short, sometimes one word, sometimes a short sentence. Her guidance. Again, handwritten on the back of other pages. One thing I like, has guidance failed? Where have you failed? Where God guides, God provides. Witness powerfully, share deeply. And I'm going to close with two letters on Ann Smith. One was written by Dorothy Murray from Cleveland, Ohio. And this will take about 5 more minutes and then we'll close. And this is what she had to say about Ann Smith. My husband was 34 and an alcoholic. Other people drank normally. My husband just got drunk. Then that first meeting. I'll be honest here. The meeting was in someone's home. I halted, again, Dr. Ball, I halted on the threshold that first evening, fearful, not knowing what might be ahead. I doubted the whole occasion. This was Joe's affair. If it would bring about his sobriety, okay, but it was not for me. I felt I didn't need it. Further, I rather enjoyed the hard shell I built around myself. No one could hurt me any further. I had been shamed and ostracized and pitied. I was proof against further hurts. And then this greeting. Come in, my dear. If she had pitied me, I would have fled in anger and disgrace. She was wise enough to know that. She understood. She knew that most wives of alcoholics feel fear. But you couldn't be afraid with Ann. That love of Ann's changed things. Time after time, I saw her melt some other person's heart. A proud woman, a hard-shelled woman, walked in belligerently. Call me Ann, my dear. That love cracked the proud woman. Turn her over. and was a good listener. She knew the therapy of getting things off your chest. In those early days, most of us didn't have telephones. We were handed a little address book. We were told all our homes are open to you. Drop in anytime. And I do have one of Ann Smith's address books with all of the early members from Akron, Cleveland, Toledo, and surrounding areas. What an honor it is to have one of these. In those early days, most of us didn't have a telephone. Okay, so we did the guidance book, the address book. Many a time, Joe and I dropped in on Dr. Bob and Ann for a potluck meal. We might have bread and milk for supper. We might have corned beef hash for Sunday. There were no apologies. Everybody was honest and genuine. Those were the days when with many people at the table, we might have 11 kinds of potatoes. All too important by alcoholics. I wonder if any of us today appreciate how pitifully poor most of us were in those early struggling days. I'll tell you this, you know, I have a hard time even getting through this. Whew. I mean, this is telling it like it is from the Al-Anon perspective. And made me realize that all these years of misery have been of some account because I've been able to translate them into usefulness and helpfulness for other people. I think of her every time I hear that familiar but little understood verse, "He that loseth his life shall save it." Anne lost herself in her work for AA. Thereby she gained a new and bigger life. A Cleveland minister in writing about AA summed things up with this sentence. "Freedom is the ability to get outside yourself and lose yourself in the thoughts and activities of others." This is what Anne did. I'm going to close with Henrietta Dodson, the wife of AA number 3. This is her handwritten letter, her tribute to Anne. Thank you, Smitty. This came by Smitty, Dr. Bob's son. On Friday, June 28, 1935, I met Ann Smith. I met Dr. Bob on Thursday morning in the hospital. When I went to the house on Ogmore Avenue, I met the most thoughtful, understanding person I have ever known. I addressed her as Mrs. Smith, and she said, "Ann, to you, my dear." She wanted to remove all barriers. Bill W. was there at the time. After they talked with me for a while, Ann asked if I would like to go all the way with God. I told her I would, and Ann said we should kneel, which we all did. She told me to surrender myself to God and to ask Him to reveal His plan to me. Again, keep in mind, in the summer of 1935, Ann was the leader and Bill and Bob were the students. Ann was the teacher. Ann taught me how to have a quiet time in the morning that I might receive strength for the day, step 11. She taught me to surrender my husband to God and not to try to tell him how to stay sober. Now that's pure Al-Anon. She said, "Love of God is triangular." The recovery triangle came from Ann Smith. The power is at the top and you and I are equal at the bottom. And I have notes of people sitting in her workshops describing recovery being triangular. "It must flow from God through me, through you, and then back to God." In the early part of 1936, Ann organized a women's group for the wives of alcoholics, whereby in a loving way she tried to teach us patience, love, and unselfishness. When I met and talked with this intelligent, deeply spiritual woman, I was completely sold on the program. And use the triangle to represent recovery. God, or God as we understand God, is at the top of the triangle, and you are at the base of the triangle. And used to talk about God speaking directly to us as two-way prayer, and God speaking to us through other people as three-way prayer. She's the only person I know that's ever used that term, three-way prayer. Whether we hear somebody in a meeting, we read something in a book or see something in a movie, that's three-way prayer, receiving messages directly from God through other people. Thank you, Anne. Anne was a remarkable woman, a spiritual giant, and most assuredly one of AA's unsung heroes. Thank you for letting me share. Silence. Our Father,